This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the 1940s, Great Britain was a world leader in computing technology. The Brits were responsible for the world's first electronic programmable computer that cracked enemy codes and helped the Allies win the war. But three decades later, their computing industry was nearly extinct. My guest today argues that this decline was in large part due to a systematic gender discrimination in the workforce. Marie Hicks is a history professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology. She authored the new book, Programmed Inequality: How Britain Discarded Women Technologists and Lost Its Edge in Computing. She's going to talk about the book tonight at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, but first she joins me in the studio. Marie Hicks, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
We talked to you a while ago about this as you were developing this material. Now you've got a book. A historian of technology, what got you interested in this subject?
Well, you know, before I went back to school for my history degree at Duke, I was actually a Unix systems administrator for a while. And the gendered divisions that I saw in that job were the opposite of what I expected. There were more women from older generations there than in the generation that I was in at the time. And it got me thinking about, how did this gendered labor change occur? Why is computing so male-identified now?
And it is true. I mean, today, if you talk to anybody, even today, there is a strong identification with men in the computer industry. But you say it wasn't always so. And particularly in Great Britain, what took you to Great Britain?
Well, what took me to the UK is that they were so far out ahead early on. You know, they had the first digital electronic programmable computer during the war that really helped the Allies win the war. And then afterwards, they're leading or matching American advancements. They seem poised to really be a strong competitor to U.S. industry. And then all of a sudden, they collapse.
So why is that? And of course, you make the point that the U.S. at this point, which is now the leader, back then wasn't. And in fact, they were still using kind of mechanical computing devices mostly. And they, I guess, were leaving it to the Brits during World War II.
Yeah, well, the British were technologically very, very advanced, but as is often the case, the best technology doesn't always win. It's about how it gets implemented. And one of the things that the British do that maybe initially seemed unrelated is they systematically push women out of the field. And in a country with a small labor force in a nascent field, this is really a big problem because the women were actually the technical ones. The field of computing was feminized up until the 1940s and 50s.
Well, let's talk more about that before we find out how and why they were pushed out. Let's find out how they got there in the first place and why there were so many women in that industry in the 1940s.
Yeah, that's a great question. The reason that the women were there was because nobody really wanted to do this machine work. Technical work wasn't very high prestige for a long time. It was seen as sort of almost working class. There was this term, the industrialization of the office. And so if women were going to be in industry, maybe doing sort of light industry, well, why not bring them in to run these machines in an office context? And so they weren't really even seen as white-collar workers.
And if we can take it back a step, the whole Industrial Revolution really is, when we talk about feminizing industry, I mean, this is part of a long tradition, or at least a century-old tradition, of changing industry and changing technology that became more and more, in some ways, women's work.
Very much so. And the interesting thing about the field of computing, I think, is that it kind of goes the opposite way with feminization than you might expect. Usually the addition of more machinery and more automation to a field feminizes it. What happens with computing is that the more and more automation we get, the more masculinized the field actually gets.
Now, is that in this period, in the 1940s? Because apparently women populated the industry at that moment.
That's in the period after the war, yeah. So late 1950s through 1970s.
So I want to talk more about women in this field and again, this notion of feminization, because this is in part what pushes some of the fears and anxieties of men in the late 19th century, and it certainly lingers today and is an important factor in American politics and Western politics, this fear of women sort of competing with men on an equal footing. Right.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And the other thing was that there was this huge fear from people at the top of government and industry that they didn't have the right sort of people in charge of these machines that were now being seen as newly important. Around the 1950s and 1960s, there's a realization that the people who know how to wield computers' power, they're going to actually be the ones who should be making big decisions about how companies are run, about how the government, the nation is run. And, you know, they're not really too keen to have low-level women technical workers in those roles.
What was the level of input from women? Are they just data entry? Are they typing data into these computers? Now, we're taking us back to the 1940s, because remember, as you pointed out, digital technology in Great Britain was one of the things that helped the Allies win the war. They could crack codes, and that was a key factor in helping the Allies win the war. So this kind of technology and being advanced in Great Britain was very important. Were women doing the math?
Yes. In the early decades of electronic computing and prior to that with electromechanical, women were doing everything from data input to programming. But the interesting thing is they were almost always called operators, even if they were doing programming. So we have to kind of look at the history in a critical light because they didn't get the titles that we might have expected.
And there are, you show cartoons from the period, too, that really suggest that diminish and kind of are sort of reductive about the importance of this work, right?
Very much so. Cartoons and especially advertisements, especially in the 1960s, as companies are trying to sell their mainframe products, they want to use women in their ads because they want employers to think, if I buy this big expensive machine, I don't have to buy a lot of, or I don't have to hire a lot of expensive workers as well.
Yeah. So, and it's so easy that even, I mean, the implication is, and given the cultural expectations of the time, so easy even a woman can do it, right?
Right. And that you won't have to train people.
Mm-hmm. Or pay them. But so now let's talk about this moment. The British, as you say, that the war is over, men are coming back. But the British, as a policy decision, decide that computing is too important to be left to women. Now it's going to be a managerial responsibility as well as a technical one. And you have the specter of women who had created these machines, operated them, now training men to become their supervisors.
Exactly. So after the war, as electronic computing starts to enter offices, women are still doing the jobs. There isn't just a flight of women from the field after the war. But as you point out, what happens is that managers, for instance, start to say, oh, okay, you're going to train new people to do this work. And then after, for instance, a woman trains her replacements, essentially, she's demoted oftentimes into an assistantship position below people who know far less than she does.
I want to get back to something you said just a second ago. There may have been this idea that after the war, the men come back and the women are now going to go back to their households where they want to be. But that was not the case. Women were staying at work.
That's 100% correct. The idea that women just kind of leave the workforce en masse after World War II is a fiction.
So now you've got, the specter of women who may have wanted to stay in jobs that they have created and helped to evolve, training people who would become their managers. What's the net impact at that moment on the industry itself? Do they leave? Do they continue to work for these managers? What does the industry look like in this period?
Well, the impact early on is not that bad because, as you sort of intimate, women don't leave at that point. They're still in the field, but they're not rising. They're not allowed to basically get on these new career tracks that are being established for computer workers, for computer professionals now.
And obviously there's little encouragement, or is there? Does this sort of make its way down the education chain in terms of a signal in the academy that women aren't needed in this profession? So, you know, you need not apply and need not apply for entry into the university as well.
I think that definitely happens later, but at this point in time, it's definitely something that you see in job advertisements. Women are being hired into low-level jobs, not necessarily ones that are low skill, but ones that are low pay and don't have a career structure. And then men are being pitched the computing jobs that are going to become more like the computing jobs we're familiar with today.
So as you so we're now at this moment when this transition is taking place. And at this moment, if we take a snapshot of the beginning of this transition, Britain's still the world leader in computer technology. What happens in the, over the next 10 or 15 years?
Yeah, they're right up there, and they're struggling to computerize and to do it well. And unfortunately, at this moment is when the government, which is the largest user and largest trainer of computer labor, decides to make this wholesale switch to using essentially young management-oriented men as technical labor and pretty much shutting out all the people who are already trained in the field. And as you can imagine, when you try to make a switch like this, you're going to end up with a much smaller labor pool than you otherwise would have.
So they end up creating this labor shortage for themselves in this emerging and very important field.
Exactly. And this is the exact time when you don't want a labor shortage like this. The other thing is that a lot of the folks who are being highly encouraged to go into the field, these young men, they don't want to be in the field because it was seen as low status work. And sometimes, you know, they are trained. It's very expensive to train them. They go into it for a little while and then they leave and they go on and do non-technical management work.
And had Britain nationalized this industry or pretty much nationalized the industry by then?
Not quite yet. The nationalization happens a bit later in the late 1960s, and it really happens in part in response to this dearth of labor. The British decide to essentially have all of the last remaining computing companies merge down into one mega company to provide solutions, computing solutions for the British government. And the reason they want these huge centralized mainframes is because they have so little available labor to run them.
Now, the U.S. has since become and the leader in this field, but you can't tell me that for some reason the U.S. had far more progressive both government or corporate policies at this point.
Right. It was very, very similar in terms of discrimination. But the U.S. had something that was very, very important, and that was a much larger population and a much larger labor force. There was more slop in the system, in a sense. And so the U.S. wasn't as badly affected by having a lot of these same discriminatory policies in place.
And you point out in your book that while it's interesting, having a much larger labor pool to choose from, if you're discriminatory and you're going to discriminate against women, that leaves you still a lot more men to choose from, and you may luck out and get some who are qualified. The but when you compare the U.S. to the Soviet Union at the same time, that provides a fascinating insight, given the kind of economic turmoil that the Soviet Union was in after World War II.
Yeah, if you look at the space race, for instance, and you look at how early on the Soviets are beating the United States, well, that should never have happened given our relative positions coming out of World War II. Margot Shetterly's terrific book that talks about black women workers at NASA, it shows how discrimination really held the United States back, especially held NASA back. These women were incredible, and if they had been able to contribute fully, just think how much farther we might have gotten.
Meanwhile, because of the dramatically poor economic conditions in the Soviet Union, they couldn't afford to discriminate and hadn't. And so women were an important part of their computer technology field and as well as in their space program.
Right, right. And their ideology was, I think, quite different as well.
So it's fascinating to see in that place where there wasn't discrimination against women and for every other reason they should have been way, way behind in the space race and the technology race, they were able to compete toe-to-toe and, in fact, for a while be ahead of the United States.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it just goes to show what a huge effect discrimination can have on even a national economy.
What about these days? I mean, you think about the global economic environment where it's discrimination, it seems to me, is a little more difficult to conscience for the same reasons that you point out early on. We can't afford to discriminate, especially in a global economy. Are things getting any better for women and in the U.S. or in Britain just because of the demands of global competition?
Well, I think things are certainly changing, and in some respects, they're getting better for certain women. In some respects, they're not. I don't really think that competition is going to save us, because I do think global competition often has the effect of dragging folks down to basically the lowest level. And I am a little bit skeptical about this idea of the STEM pipeline that we hear a lot of the time, that if we can just train enough women to take up these jobs, eventually they'll make it through the pipeline and end up at the highest levels of industry. That's been going on for decades now. And what we're seeing is the pipeline leaks in the middle. And people of color, women, other minorities really don't ever make it to the top in large numbers.
What accounts for that? What are you seeing in Silicon Valley, for instance, today?
Well, I think what accounts for that is that we have this fiction of meritocracy. We want to believe that the best and brightest rise to the top. And it's simply not true. Privilege, class, gender, race play a huge role in where people end up in society.
Did the British, for instance, recognize this? I mean, clearly they saw their lagging position, their declining position by the 1970s. Did they do anything to address this? And did they ever come to the recognition or realization that discrimination played a part?
That's the really fascinating thing. They had all of the evidence in front of them. They saw everything that was happening. They were producing reports all about it. And they sort of crept almost up to the point of realizing what had happened. Women labor unionists realized what had happened, but the government itself couldn't really bring itself to fully accept what they had done and why they had done it until a long time after, I would say.
Does that result, even if it took that long to figure it out, does that result in a change in policy? I mean, how do you change a culture that's so embedded in this kind of discrimination that it can't even recognize its own the damage that it does to its own system?
I hope so. I hope that it will result in more changes in policy. It has resulted in some, but of course the problem is it's one step forward or two steps back, and we don't see linear progress. We see changes that are helpful and progressive, and then we often see a rollback of those changes.
Can you tell what part of this, again, moving forward, is the lag of corporate culture or even political culture, just a habit of thinking this way about women and about minorities, and, you know, sort of these countervailing pressures, the real need by any business, whether it wants to or not, or whether it sees the need or not, to have the best and the brightest, to embrace meritocracy. What's the tension in those two forces?
Well, I think there's a real tension between getting the best people into these jobs and maintaining power. Governments, corporations, they all have specific hierarchies and power structures that they're very invested in, because that's how they function. That's how they keep going. And they don't want to change that very much, because if they do, then they're going to have to rethink everything about their existence, essentially.
So in a lot of ways, any efforts, affirmative efforts that crack these structures and cultural habits allow for a broader workforce and a broader thought base to get in and change that very sort of root thinking that can lead to even bigger changes later on.
Exactly. And that's extraordinarily dangerous in a way. That's going to change the entire system potentially.
Well, hopefully this is the first step in that process. Mary Hicks, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Mary Hicks is a professor of history at the Illinois Institute of Technology. She wrote the new book, Programmed Inequality, How Britain Discarded Women Technologists and Lost Its Edge in Computing. She's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop tonight at 7 o'clock in Durham, North Carolina, and we have details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, two Native American judges use tribal justice to restore their communities. Stay tuned.